Today is Monday. It's June 2nd, 2025. This is part 17 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Barbara Phillips. Barbara spells her last name P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S. This interview today is happening at the home of Hazel Clark and Tom Martin here in our little dining room. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Barb. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Great. Barb, last time we were talking about you're wrapping up a bunch of ongoing studies while at the same time you got hired by the Forest Service. And this is 1990-1991-ish time frame?
Yeah, 1990 I actually got hired.
Okay. Last time we kind of set the stage for an invasive species plant study at Tonto National Monument. And was that a study that you had, one of those studies you'd set up before taking the Forest Service job?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it was something that I maybe noticed while I was working on the fire study.
Okay.
And
That there were invasive species?
That there's invasive species. Well, of course, the grasses had been a big cause. The non-native grasses from South Africa that had been planted on the forest around the monument helped spread the fire into the monument because the grasses came into the monument first, okay. And then they came in much more abundantly after each fire because of the habitat that was created by the fires.
Okay.
And then other plants were coming in because of the tourists bringing them in or whatever. And so I noticed that as I was working around on the monument on the studies. And so
The exotic grasses, you had mentioned that the Forest Service had planted those outside the monument.
Right, those, on the forest.
Those grasses, I may have asked you this last time.
I didn't say the names of them, but yeah.
Okay, do they like to burn? Are they fire adapted? And I'm assuming that the elevation of the Tonto is going to be 2,500, 3,000 feet?
I don't remember exactly what it is, but it goes from Saguaro Desert into a little bit of juniper.
And that habitat is not fire adapted.
The desert part is not. Right. Yeah.
So now there's grass in the desert.
Right, yeah.
And that's going to burn.
Yeah.
What happens to the Sonoran Desert or the Saguaro Desert habitat when exotic grasses burn in them?
Okay, I think I mentioned that a little bit before, but I have a document that I just want to mention that someone did after I did mine.
Okay.
And he has some photos, matching photos in it, and one of the photos was taken from a place where I did the studies on the fires, and it shows lots of saguaros along the whole slopes in front of the ruins there.
Okay.
And this is taken from basically at the boundary with the forest. And so now you look back and the 1991 photo and there's no saguaros.
So here's a 1964 picture,
right,
and here's a 1991 picture. And so in this 30 years, roughly, a little less, 25 years.
Right, the saguaros have died.
The saguaros have all died.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Do you think fire did that?
Oh, yeah. This is the area where all the fires came in. I showed you it was a little fire, then a bigger fire, then another fire.
All over the same area.
There's another part of the park, Monument Park. It changed their names. But where that didn't happen, and the saguaros are doing fine.
Okay.
But I think I mentioned to you that there was one plot that I put in, basically uphill from this,
right,
where it had in 1990 or 89 or 90, when I put in the plot, it had a saguaro in it, and I went back to find the plot, and there was no saguaro there. It had fallen on the ground, and it made it really hard to, you know, see from a distance where my plot was.
Yeah.
So that was the influence, and since I couldn't keep going working on Tonto National Monument because I had the job with the Forest Service, they the Park Service still wanted to do more documentations of it, and so Frank Reichenbacher and his colleagues got the contract to work on the vegetation inventory, okay, and more monitoring, and used, you know, my documents and some of the basic stuff that I came up with and followed up on it. So that's how these projects go. You work as long as you can on them, mm-hmm, and then have somebody else will come along and you know, 10, 20 years later, in this case it wasn't that much later, but right. Right. It was, you know, like you said, like maybe 30 years from the initial fires, you're dealing with different people being able to work out in the field and cover things.
Right. Now, I'm assuming that the Forest Service had a lot of work for you to do, because sometimes the Park Service can put money into the Forest Service for a Forest Service employee to do some work for the Park Service. But clearly, that's when the Forest Service doesn't have a lot for that person to do. Hmm. So if the money works out, because there's money shifting from agency to agency. Yes. But I'm just kind of curious, when you first came to the U.S. Forest Service, I mean, have we covered this? What you want?
Yeah,
to say
I just wanted to say, and then, like I did another report on the invasive plants there, and that was the first I'd ever really worked with invasive plants. But just the concept, you know, the grasses that they're putting out. Right. When I came to the forest, I was ready to say, stop putting out these grasses. You know?
Did you?
Well, I did, but they didn't stop it for a while, because the range people were happy to have grasses for their cows to eat, because they had grazed down all the native plants. And so they were happy with these new African introduced plants that
How long
well.
Did it take you to...
It took a while, like quite a while.
Decades or years?
No.
Or...
Okay, in invasive plants, this was my first start, was on the Tonto, and then I came to the forest. I basically could develop a program because there had been a lady on Three Forests. She had been on, the Coconino, Kaibab, and Tonto National Forests.
Okay.
Prior to me, for a couple of years, and she had been this zone person. And when they advertised for my position, the Tonto didn't go in on it, but it became the Coconino, Kaibab, and Prescott National Forest, all adjacent to each other again.
Okay.
Okay. So there had been some work that she had done on rare plants and also floras a bit, and on the two forests that I was inheriting, which were the Coconino and the Kaibab.
Right.
In the Prescott, that kind of program hadn't existed. So it was new for the Prescott. So when I came into the, mainly Greg Goodwin, the biologist on the Coconino, was my main boss. But I had two other bosses for the different forests.
Okay.
But they were equal to Greg, but he was the one that sort of evaluated me and stuff. He talked to the other people about it.
So
but the program...
Each forest had a biologist, and you had to report...
I had to answer to all
three, but your main...
My main
director
was Greg.
Was Greg.
And so Greg
Coconino.
Okay. Coconino. Yeah.
Okay. Who was the woman you mentioned who had worked the Three Forests, done the Tonto stuff before you? Do you remember who that was?
I do. It'll take me a minute to come up with her name.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
I'll put it in there when I...
Yeah. And just what do you remember about her?
Oh, yeah.
And did she tell you, hey, Barb, you know, you're coming into this and check out these grasses because they're hammering...
No, she didn't. We didn't talk really overlapping that. One of the reasons was she went on to another job in New Mexico, and she was just overwhelmed with the new job, and so she didn't really kibitz on her previous job because you know, she was off over there.
And she was was she a botanist like you?
Yes, she was a botanist.
Yeah. So what happened there is there was an institutional memory gap. She wasn't able to kind of bring you up to speed as the
project. Well, she told me where the documents were and things like that. Okay. And she'd made a herbarium on the Kaibab National Forest, which is in the supervisor's office. She also made some collections on the North Kaibab. Okay. There were plants up there. So no, I knew I knew what she had done, and I had documents that showed where she'd done the monitoring of these different species and that sort of thing. So I took over on that part. Mm. On Coconino, Coconino was managed a little different in that they had the district people were the district biologists, usually the biologists, had over their own district the responsibility of looking for the plants and incorporating them in men with, you know, what they're doing on the range and different treatments and things. So there was more of a underlayer on this. The Kaibab didn't, it had range people in the same positions.
Okay. So help me with the structure here for a minute, because I think of the Kaibab National Forest as a unit and the Coconino National Forest as a unit and the Prescott National Forest as a unit.
Right.
Is there like a regional or a district where the management starts going up that looks at bigger and bigger areas?
Right. Yeah, that's sort of the way it is. There's the districts on the forests.
Okay.
Okay. And so, the number of districts varies.
Kaibab National Forest would have a number of districts. So the Kaibab National Forest would have districts in the Kaibab National Forest?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And same with the Coconino?
And same with the Prescott's.
So the forest is made up of districts. What is made up of, makes up forests?
Okay. If I'm going up. Right, yeah, right. So the forests that I was on were in Arizona. There's also forests in New Mexico. And the forests in Arizona and New Mexico have a regional office that's in Albuquerque.
Regional, okay, that's regional sort of, yeah.
Office in Albuquerque.
All right.
The hierarchy doesn't go in the fact, we interact at the same level of the people in, like if there's a botanist in the regional office, I interact with that person, but they aren't a boss of me or a boss of anybody on the Coconino. Right. A lot of people are more consulting and then they're looking at the bigger picture and then they're answering to Washington more stuff.
Got it.
But there's the administrative level and then there's the people on the grounds kind of level. And I was sort of in between the two.
Okay.
But I always wanted to be out in the field, so I didn't try to progress up beyond the level that I would be out in the field.
Right, which makes sense.
Right, yeah. And then the district people, quite a few of them want to go on and move up because you get more money, you know, you get more prestige, you get more, you know, power or whatever.
Right.
But I never felt that need at my level because I was doing enough that was interesting anyway. And I didn't want to leave Flagstaff, and so I was limited in where I was going to
go.
Work and stay. I could go to Prescott back in a day. I mean, it was hard to go and work all day long and then come back. After a bit, Greg said, no, stay overnight. You've got the budget to stay overnight.
Okay.
So when you go to a meeting, an all-day meeting, I was telling him that, you know, I'd get in the car and then I'd drive just before the interstate. I'd pull over and take a nap so that I wouldn't be groggy on the interstate.
Yeah.
And he says, no, you know, go make arrangements to stay overnight.
Okay.
And eventually I had friends that were in near Prescott, and they said, oh, come to our house, we'll stay
with us.
I stayed with them, and that was great, you know. And
cool.
So it worked out real fine.
And so that didn't eat into your per diem budget.
Right.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the gas did, but not.
Right. So that first year, 91, that you worked for the Forest Service?
90. I started May 1990.
Okay. So to May 1991, or even in through 1991, mm-hmm. Well, you wrapped up your studies.
The ones that weren't on the forest,
the ones that weren't on forest. Do you remember what studies you would have started on the forest?
Well, first I looked at what Renee, the previous botanist, had done.
Renee, what was her last name?
Galliano.
Renee, how do you spell Galliano?
G-A-L-E-A-N-O, Galliano.
Okay.
Pop, hyphenated pop, P-O-P-P.
Okay.
Okay. So I looked at her things that she had worked on, and I developed a plan, a five-year plan.
Okay.
You know, for my boss on each forest, and you know, approximately what we could do and cover. And I learned very quickly, or shall we say within a year or so, that everything I thought would take maybe a day to do would take at least a week. Everything I thought would take a week would take a month. Everything I thought would take a month took a year. You know, I mean, you had to put a different ending on each thing. So I think after about 10 years, I had some of the five-year things accomplished. But it gave you, you know, goals. And then, of course, new ones came in.
Right.
And every time we switched administrations, there would, of the government, we would have a different, slightly different goal and aims, and things would be named differently. And so there was a lot of bureaucracy to it that I'd never had to deal with at that kind of intimate level of having to change focus and stuff like that. But, and then I also had the opportunity to think up new ideas.
Okay.
Because we'd gone from just knowing that there were rare plants and looking for them on the forests where they might be, and that sort of thing, to perhaps monitoring them if they needed it, to developing documents about them. Some of them were enough rare and threatened and everything that the national government was saying, hey, you know, maybe we need to list these. And the forest didn't want everything listed because that would tie them up in what they would be able to do.
Oh, interesting.
So
handle that?
Well, I was lucky in a couple cases where there was a species that I really like. It's my favorite plant. It's an Arizona bugbane, and it occurs in the drainages of Oak Creek and up West Fork of Oak Creek, and also on Bill Williams Mountain. And it's an ancient plant that goes back, hundreds, thousands of years.
So when I think of plant communities, in creek beds, the environment's very different than up on a high mountain slope.
And why was it both places?
Yeah, that's my question.
Okay, it was on the north-facing slope of Bill Williams Mountain.
Where it was humid.
It was sort of like a amphitheater. And it was up there where there was spruce and Doug fir, and not in the Ponderosa, but up higher. And it was where the drainage came down the mountain. And if you look at a good map, you can see that. They had skiing on Bill Williams Mountain. So there is a little area there that is like being on top of the peaks.
Okay.
This species did never get on the peaks here in Flagstaff.
Oh,
or
really?
Sitgreaves or some of those other mountains. It's on Bill Williams Mountain.
Okay.
But down in Oak Creek. But see, Bill Williams Mountain goes down into
Ash Fork all the way down that
way. Well, no, not that way, but down, it goes to the upper drainages of the Verde River.
Yes.
So Verde River, you know, and Oak Creek goes into the Verde River
Canyon,
and all of that. Okay. And so it's like this, if you go up, it sort of spreads out, looking at it. So you've got these fingerings going down into the Verde River.
Right.
It also occurs on the east side of Roosevelt Lake in the Sierra Anchas, a little bit. Just a couple of canyons over there.
So it seems like it's able to handle quite a different range in elevation, mm-hmm. so long as it has cool, moist habitat.
And, or cooler, you know, snow in the winter and all this kind of thing. It's like this plant also grow, a different species grows back east. It's like a spring ephemeral. You always think of spring ephemerals being little plants. This plant is like 6 feet tall, whoa, but it's in the buttercup family.
Wow.
So it's related to, you know, the early spring species that come up.
Wow.
But it just found a good habitat. And it has more to do with geology and time and, you know, erosion and all these. And I think the reason it isn't on the peaks and everything is because those are volcanic. They're not connected to drainages the same way.
Okay.
And, you know, Bill Williams is too, but it's right close to the drainage. And so it came up. So they could go down. Think of the, some of the plants in the, you know, Sycamore Canyon and the side drainages in the Sycamore Canyon have different plants in them than what's up on the peaks.
And there's water in Sycamore Canyon.
Yeah, there's water.
But there's no water on the peaks.
Right, yeah.
So,
Yeah. So, anyway.
Well, that's cool.
That was a really interesting plant.
Okay.
And it was rare enough that, like I said, I told you the locations where, well, it does occur in West Clear Creek, too.
Okay.
Okay, so down there, there's a little bit of several little smaller populations down there.
Okay.
So there was a thought that maybe this should be a species that would be listed. However, regionally, the you're talking about what do regional people do? Regional people have research areas that they define, and so they decided to, whoever was in the regional office decided to make part of Oak Creek, especially West Fork of Oak Creek, into a regional research area.
Yeah.
So that meant that it was supposed to have more natural. It's like a wilderness, but not quite a wilderness.
Okay.
And so the impacts wouldn't be like what we were worried about was them cutting in and cutting all the trees on the rims of the canyon, which would affect, in the long run, it would affect the whole canyon because, you know, it would.
And this was for timber harvest?
Yeah, for timber
or
harvest.
Or housing development, or both?
No, mostly for timber at that time.
Okay.
This is, we're talking, you know, late 1980s.
Okay.
That they were working on that. So it just happened that they named that area right when I came on the forest. And so that sort of took away the pressure of, you know, I still had to develop a document that was like an ultra status report. I think I've talked about status reports before, but there was a management plan for this that Fish and Wildlife would also agree that the actions that the forest was taking was protective of this plant. So that was the start of working on strategic plans for certain species that if they didn't have those plans and be signed off by Fish and Wildlife, then they would have gone on to being listed. And then the forest has more, has to deal with more bureaucracy about the, you know, with Fish and Wildlife Service and with the regional office and everything like that. And the forest likes to, you know, handle its own projects and such. So one thing they had been proposing for that is the helicopter thinning, like they're now doing on the peaks, but they were trying to think about coming into Oak Creek and doing that because it is very rugged country and everything like that.
Yeah.
And it's a better as a recreation area. I mean, it really is.
Right.
And there was just the beginning of that Northern Arizona becoming a recreation.
And the whole
place
Red Rocks Pass concept.
Oh, that was later. Yeah.
Okay. And,
but
all Sedona.
But it allowed recreation to become in more dominant than timber.
Got it.
That whole area.
Yeah.
Or than cows, or than...
I want to back up for a minute. You mentioned you did your first 5-year plan. Do you remember what else was on that plan?
Well, I did have listed species on the forest. We already had...
Like identify what the listed species are and look for them?
We just had to study them more because we didn't know that much about them and we wanted to follow them over time.
Okay.
And that's the advantage of the kind of monitoring plots that we put in, is that it's over time and then you're studying the biology of the plant at the same time. And then you also look at the potential impacts to the area. The Arizona cliff rose occurs down around Cottonwood.
Okay.
And across the river on the north bank, basically, not on the south bank much, but on the north side. And that was one that had been listed.
That's along the Verde?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So that one had been listed.
Hang on a second. You mentioned this plant is location sensitive, like north side, south side. So if it's on the north side, does that mean it's liking more sun?
No, the issue, this issue has quite a few problems. I did a paper on this too. We had a conference on rare plants. I don't know the exact date off the top of my head, but we had a conference on it, and I decided to concentrate on the Verde Valley plants.
Okay.
And this Persia was one of them. I had worked on, as we did with the pediococcus, I had worked on, you know, finding the plants, putting, you know, making a status report, doing a
the plots, the...
Well, not the plots in this case, but just the plans for a listed endangered species.
Okay.
And so I was already very familiar with it. That's from the time I worked at the museum.
Okay.
So that was on the list, but there were other species there that wouldn't make the endangered category. Smaller plants that we had discovered also like this. It's in the down part of the Verde River. There's really old lake bed deposits, and there's some of them that are intermixed with volcanic materials and things like that.
Like volcanic ash type?
Yeah, volcanic ash things.
Okay.
And the composition of the soil, therefore, is pretty unique. Some plants can't grow on it, so the competition isn't as great, and those plants that can grow on it do well there.
Okay.
So this Persia, which is a cliff rose, has been segregated out from the normal cliff rose you think of when you, around here, you know, the big shrubby, big, this one, it can get 4 feet tall, 5 feet tall, barely, but it's very delicate, blanky kind of thing. It flowers at a different time. It has a lot of associated insects with it and things. It's got a good community associated with it, but it's just different than the one that's up here.
A subspecies or its own unique species?
I think it's a species. It's a species level. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think it's ever been anything else. But so then there's some other lower growing, what you call small shrubs or perennial plants that are in the same habitat that don't occur elsewhere too. So it made sense to make a botanical area out of that area. Mm. And that's called, I guess it's called the Verde Valley Botanical Area. The other thing I did was find people who were interested in working for free, like volunteers and such.
Right.
And somebody decided he wanted to do the flora of the botanical area. So he worked on that for many years. And then years later, another person came along who decided, well, he's actually an architect. That's Max Leiker. And
who was the first person who came in? You remember? Okay, so Max, how do you spell Max's last name?
Licher.
And he was an architect.
He's an architect still in Sedona.
Okay.
He decided he did, you know, a floor of one area. He worked with the district biologist level. And after that, he said, well, where else can you, where else do you want some? And because of the recreation impacts and things in the Verde Valley, they had, you know, oh, can you go do this area and find out what's there? Can you go do this area and do that? And cool. So he is concentrated in the Verde Valley area mostly. He's done some up here too, but anyway. So these volunteers would come along and either they were, most of them were either sort of interested in range or he is unusual in that he was an architect. But whatever their interest is, he became a very good botanist and has done all this.
Cool. Cool.
So identifying things like that.
As a volunteer.
As a volunteer.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's not in retirement age at all. So.
Okay.
Well, maybe now, but not then. So there were different ways to get things going. The other thing I did was I looked at, you know, the Arboretum where I'd applied, but that's not the job I took.
Right.
Had hired a botanist, Joyce Mashinsky. And she was willing to work on contracts too, and work on rare plants. She was wanting to work on plants, rare plants.
Okay.
So, and there was somebody at ASU that was in the herbarium that was willing to apply. You know, and so there was a little bit of competition there. Some of them, they knew approximately how much money we had for a project. We could just say, you know, we have $5,000 for this project. Or if it goes up in a higher amount, some of them are limited by $25,000. It has to be competitive. So you have to go out to a number of people and have them apply and take, they have to be qualified. They can't just say, hey, I'm going to do the work. And if they don't have any experience doing the work, you know.
Right. So a question about Joyce. Had you met her before you got the job with the Forest Service?
We were competition for her job. She got it.
She got the Forest Service job.
No. Arboretum.
She got the Arboretum job.
Right.
Right.
And I got the Forest Service job. Right. I don't know if she applied to the Forest Service, but I applied to the Arboretum, and she got the Arboretum one, and I got the Forest Service one.
What do you remember about her?
Oh, she was wonderful. She was very, very bright and positive kind of person, and very she's just kept going on her career and interested in rare plants, and she stayed around here for many years, and then she went to Florida and worked down there at Garden Complex down there.
What a change, a great career. Though. Huh? I'm coming Flagstaff to Florida? Humidity, bugs, swamp. Alligators?
Yeah, I wouldn't have gone there, but she did. So, So, but she loved going to the different national meetings and things like that, and she became very active in all the rare plant stuff. And she's younger than I am, so she retired probably 10 years after I did. So.
Okay. All right.
But while she was here, she did work on several different projects on the...
For the Forest Service?
For the Forest Service.
Okay.
Coconino.
Do you remember which ones?
Well, she worked on some of the bug bay, some of the Arizona cliff rose in the Verde Valley. Put in monitoring there, which some of that monitoring's continued a long time. She did a project on the. can you stop that for a second?
It's all right. I'll cut it out.
Okay. Well, we had Hedioma, and another species that grows. I don't know why names just click out on you when you want to say them, but anyway, I can picture it just fine. So she got a grant to do some surveys for that.
She was working on different projects.
Different projects, yeah. Right. And
was she working under Greg or was she working under you?
Was at the Arboretum.
Yes, but when she's working, doing the work with the Forest Service, how'd that work?
Or
was she paid by the Arboretum?
No. This would be something that she brought in to the Arboretum. I would write the proposal up of what we needed.
Okay.
Okay. And then she would have to say how that she was going to do it and how much it was going to cost and build up the budget for it, really, and the timeline and everything. And of course, we would have a timeline of...
So if I understand this right, she basically, as the Arboretum, would compete for Forest Service contracts to get the work done for the Forest Service, but the money would then go to the Arboretum.
We would be managing it too. We were managing a contract.
Yeah.
And so, the contracting office at the Forest Service, she would have to meet their requirements, but she would have to, run it through the budget office of the Arboretum.
Yeah.
And they would have some overhead, I'm sure.
Exactly.
That sort of thing. It was just
exactly
all the standard
gave her
thing.
Work. It gave money from the Forest Service to the Arboretum, which is good.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And I don't know how much of her work was strictly on the Arboretum or whatever, but I assume she had a number of different contracts, and she just had to parcel up her time and into these different
places. Exactly.
I mean, that's the way those go.
Yeah.
That's what I did when I worked at the museum. I was on different contracts
And
stuff. Exactly. And I had some that didn't go through the museum. It just went directly to me.
Mm.
And she probably had some that just went directly to her and didn't go through.
Sure. Something. She would do that as an independent person.
Yeah. I remember years later calling her up on the San Francisco Peaks Groundsel and saying, if you could get me a proposal tomorrow on this, we have the money to go. And she goes like, what? I can't make it.
Tomorrow?
I can't do it that fast. I can't go that. And I said, that's the turnaround on these things. You've got to be ready. And I said, some advice to you is to, know what we're probably going to be working on and have things ready so that you can do that kind
of
a turnaround.
When you get the phone call, you say, I'll send that to you in half an hour. I got it all ready.
Yeah. And she was kind of like, but, I don't know how that one worked out, but I remember telling her at one point, we need it tomorrow on my desk tomorrow.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Okay. So your 5-year plan.
So I did a 5-year plan. Like I said, they probably took mostly 10 years to get done. The other thing happens is, as I said, with new administrations or new focus areas or whatever new issues that come along, once I got here and all of a sudden invasive plants became an issue after about 5 years or so. And so I didn't know what we had on the forests because we had never looked for them.
Oh, wow.
And see, I'd looked for them on the Tonto. I knew what was down there, but I didn't know it was up here. Well, it became more of an issue. Somebody just recognized it was more of an issue region-wide and everything. And so we had to start thinking about that. So that was a different focus than when I first came out.
So does the Forest Service have must have an archive, a library, certainly of papers that individual employees have published over the decades, meaning, let's take the Kaibab for an example, or the Prescott or the Cochineal, one of those. Sort of the first list of species seen by botanists in maybe 1910 or 1920s, 1930s, were those out there that you could pull from and then say, look, they had this species then, they didn't have these species listed. Doesn't mean they weren't there, it just means they didn't make it on the list.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how would you know, you're supposed to look at invasives, how would you know whether they were there for the last 50 or 60 years, or would you even care? It's just like, do we have it or not? Yes, no.
Right. Well, in a case like that with those invasive plants, they're moving.
Okay. They're new.
They've come into the state. The state had lists.
Oh, okay.
And it was an interesting story one time, once I got a little bit involved with invasive plants, and this is moving ahead, like I said, over 5 years from when I first joined the Forest Service. But there was a meeting of invasive plants where we had the state botanists came and talked to, to educate people about what's going on in the state and New Mexico and, you know, around this area. And he said, well, here's the list of the plants, and here's the plants that are, A, you know, most important to get rid of, or A, or B, or C, you know, like this, okay. And they have prohibited, and they have here but not a big concern yet, or they're more widespread. They had these different categories for them. Okay. But anyway, one of them was prohibited. And I looked at the list and I went, you've got leafy spurge on this list. Why do you have it in the prohibited thing? And he says, well, we don't want it in the state. And I said, it's in the state. It's been here since Art and I collected it in 1970. And I could tell him exactly where we collected it, at Big Springs on the North Kaibab in a horse pasture. Up there, it's also known from another place in the South Kaibab, da da da. And he goes like, oh. We had herbarium records of it. We'd put the herbarium, the plants the herbarium at the U of A.
Right. So this kind of goes to my question.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like there was an ongoing update every 5 or 10 years. This is the list of species that we see.
Well, that was the start of it.
Districts.
That was just the start of it, see. Okay. This is about 1995, so 5 or 6 or so. The state had hired somebody for invasive plants. They've always had one for the listed rare plants that they don't want people to collect without permits, sort of thing, like cactus, the lily family, various plants like that. But then they just decided they needed to get going on invasive plants.
Okay.
And then they had hired a person, like I said, that was responsible for invasive plants. But they're just beginning. And to be honest, we didn't have that many things around here. We did have the grasses that the Forest Service had brought in, but they weren't thought of as invasive. They were thought of as just nice competitive plants for the cattle to eat, you know, kind of thing. So put that aside. That stays settled there for a while. You couldn't do much to influence the range people on that. But when we started to get some of these other plants, leafy spurge ran to the top of the list immediately because it has roots that go to China. I mean, they are incredibly persistent. They're poisonous to cattle. They're sheep can graze them, but cattle can't. They form, you know, solid cover once they get going. So anyway, so there were several plants like this. And once the state decided they were going to have to control them along their roadsides and various things like that, then they developed some people that became knowledgeable.
Okay.
So it started with the state being more educated than those people on the force. And like I said, I was the only botanist in all of northern Arizona.
Okay.
There were no really botanists except contracted for a long time in southern Arizona, even though they had a lot of rare plants and things like that. The Nature Conservancy jumped in there and sort of got some of the contracts and concerns about that. So the state put on education meetings and took those of us who were interested, which in our case, I made the range people, you know, were interested in plants. So they were the people that we educated, and often just sort of the seasonal ones or you know, the lower ranked people in the districts. We went to these meetings and they would take us and show us these plants that might come onto the forest through the roads, and this road where it goes across on the railroad, you know, right of ways and things like that. Okay.
Right.
The regional, Flagstaff developed a regional segment of people when they built the new office building and the NEU campus. It's Forest Service on, you know, NEU teaching forestry over here, and over here it's research Forest Service, and they moved the researchers that were spread out and campus or whatever into this one other side of the building. And the
was that the School of Forestry or was this on Thompson, the
yeah, no.
Thompson facility? Or was it on campus?
This is on campus.
Okay.
It's the School of Forestry.
School of Forestry,
yeah. Went into one side of the building, but the other side of the building was research.
Okay.
And that was regional office people. Regional office to be more locally, involved.
Where was your office?
My office was, first it was on Greenlaw, and then it was in Thompson Street.
Okay.
Like you were talking about. Yes. And the forest still has district offices. They moved around and combined various districts and shut down some field offices and things like that over the years. But it's still spread out a bit. Because they're big, it's huge areas that we're talking about being forest lands.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, so once they started educating people about the invasive plants that either were here or could be coming this way, then we decided on the forest, this was about 1995 or six, that there were a couple people that, one of them was an engineer, he was in the engineering office and stuff, so he was involved with roads and driving around and everything. So he knew where he was when he was on the forest.
Uh-huh.
And so we just said, well, he liked plants, so here, learn these plants, and then when you go out and look at the farm ponds or you go out and look at the roadsides and stuff like that, you can
see what's there.
See what's there, yeah. And another lady on the Flagstaff district up here went around like that. She was she wanted to be a botanist more and not just a. She had worked in timber, for example, and she'd done all these different things and. And so she went along too, and so then I had two people that could go, and more safety, you know, with two people going, and they went on the, and then we went on the Kaibab too, on the same kinds of habitats and stuff. So they drove roads and whatever. So we got the eyes out there and that, and then they started doing programs where they would have like a week, or maybe not quite a week, but educational things where you actually went to say New Mexico and had a, people were presenting about the different species and so you could learn more about them and everything. So we started doing that and all of a sudden in 1998 we discovered that we were getting a new species from the Verde Valley was up here in the cinder pit at Wild Plant Treatment Plant area, you know, that hill near there.
Yeah.
And that was yellow star thistle. And yellow star thistle is poisonous to horses.
Okay.
And so in the Verde Valley, it was a real sensitive issue because if you didn't have, you know, the horses would go in your pasture and they'd eat the yellow star thistle coming along your fence line or something like that. And it does have very sharp spine things and they get in there and then they couldn't get it out and it was toxic and it was so it was bad. So we became aware of it up here.
Okay.
And we'd found different plants, like I said, at farm ponds and sort of along the roads and stuff like that. So some of us got concerned about it. It was Shelley Silbert, who was working with the Nature Conservancy out in Hart Prairie. Tina Ayers, who's the botanist that was hired at the university for the herbarium and everything, the three of us got together and said, we're going to have to develop a program here. We're going to have to educate people. We're going to have to find out what's going on and everything. Where is there some funding? What can we do? And so it turned out there was some national grant money coming.
From the Forest Service? Or Nature Conservancy?
Well, I think
NAU.
It was. I think no, not locally, nationally.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, nationally, and people could write proposals. You know, and if you got funded, you could fund a program, develop a program, and the National Resource conservation districts, which is mostly range-oriented, cattle-oriented, ranching-oriented, developed weed management areas. So over basically counties, that sort of thing. So we thought, well, we can jump in here too and get some funding and find out what we can develop. We proposed to develop a weed management area that included the Coconino National Forest above the rim, went over to the Kaibab National Forest on the south side. And then wrote a grant proposal and got funded to develop this conservation area, weed conservation area.
Who was the overseer for the funding? Was it you with the Forest Service? Was it Tina with NAU? It was you with Forest Service. Okay.
I wrote the proposals and well, we all three probably wrote the proposals together, but it was run through the Forest Service initially. And concurrently, we were working on getting a weed, what we call the weed EIS, environmental statement. We didn't know how many forests. We started out big. We thought Coconino, Kaibab, Prescott, and Tano.
Right.
Tano dropped out.
Okay.
So it ended up being a three forest weed EIS.
Why did they drop out, do you know?
Not exactly. We didn't have as close connection with them, and their habitats are different, and they have a lot of recreation issues. I don't know whether they were just overwhelmed with other things that they were dealing with at the time, but they did definitely drop out. So it ended up being the three forests, weed EIS.
And I didn't ask you, you mentioned Shelley Silbert and Tina Ayers.
A-Y-E-R-S, yeah.
Yeah. What do you remember about Shelley?
Oh, she's a good friend. She's one I still am a friend with. We worked together really well. I loved Hart Prairie. She was in charge of the Nature Conservancy there. I'd spent a lot of time out at Fern Mountain and walking around in those areas. Even when we were at the museum, I was out there.
Looking at the Bebb's Willow out there?
Yes, that's a whole other project area that I haven't touched base on at all. So that's a separate. I don't want to go off on a tangent.
We will talk about that within the Forest Service. You're going to work on that?
I worked on it during before that too. Okay. Yeah, that's a longer term project too.
So we'll put that on a list of things to talk about.
Right.
Okay.
But Shelley and so we became good friends and we worked on this weed issue for a long time.
Okay.
And then she went stopped being at the Nature Conservancy. She went over to the university for a while and then she moved to New Mexico.
Durango, didn't it?
Yeah, no, she's in Durango now, but she moved somewhere else first.
Okay,
and then Durango, but she is now married to Steve Monroe,
right?
Who was one of Chuck's last students in hydrology, and so we had a lot in common there, and. Shelley and Steve would come over.
One of Chuck Avery's students.
Yeah, Avery's students. And so they would get pizza and come over and we'd have conversations over pizza for lunch and stuff like that because Shelley and Steve, they really like Chuck too and, you know, we sort of all had good times together. So when I go to Colorado. I try to touch bases. Are they going to be around and can we get together? And if they come to Flagstaff, we try to get together and stuff. So,
and Steve was working with the USGS, wasn't he?
Yeah, he worked with the USGS on springs.
Right.
Springs in the Grand Canyon, especially, but springs with the Park Service And he also worked on LaRue Spring, which is out here in Fort Valley.
Okay.
So he did some work there, and he worked on Fossil Springs, was his probably master's. I don't think they gave PhDs in that forestry school.
Hmm.
But anyway, so yeah, he worked a long time with Chuck and got in.
And then Tina Ayers was that?
She became the herbarium curator.
Is she
in 1990.
Chuck's daughter, or is she?
No, Ayers. Tina.
Tina, yeah.
No, she's no relation to Chuck.
Okay, Avery, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Right. What do you remember about Tina?
She's very, she really liked taxonomy.
Okay.
She's very into keying out plants to figure out how plants differed from one another. She was a very good teacher.
Mm.
I did sit in on one of her courses on grasses.
Okay.
Because I was able to do it like at the end of the day. It was like 4 o'clock or 3:30 or 4 o'clock. And so I could just, you know, 1 or 2 days a week, I can't remember. We get together in a lab situation. And so I drew a lot of drawings of all these grasses and such. And I got to know some of the...
Oh, cool.
The person that sat next to me is Sue Holliday, and she's a really good friend now from that experience. And she was very active in the Native Plant Society, which I was long time active in that, and also the state president for 5 years of the Native Plant Society. That's me, not her. But she was president and treasurer of our local chapter up here. And she was into people... Students really liked the way she taught and what she taught, and she encouraged building up the herbarium with specimens, and she was able to get the Navajo herbarium incorporated here in Flagstaff.
That was Sue, or that was Tina?
Tina.
Tina, okay.
Yeah, and she retired fairly recently, last year.
Okay.
Her husband was Randy Scott, is Randy Scott, and he is a specialist in composites, the sunflower family, thistles in particular, and they had a son, and he went through BASIS, etc., and off on his own, very bright man. And
okay.
So everybody... Everything's golden in the botany arena.
I'm looking at the time here. It looks like we're just about an hour here visiting. I wonder if this would be a good place to put a comma in this interview series.
Okay.
Unless there's something else to bring in here that's not too big, because we're not...
Okay, well, we haven't... finished with invasive plants. I've just been getting started on the invasive plant
thing. Exactly.
So, because I haven't got the grants yet that we got and everything. So we've got all that to discuss.
So when you and Shelley and Tina got together to pull a grant together, was that the first one you went for invasives?
It was the first one we went for invasives. I did work with somebody from the regional Forest Service, but our proposal didn't get funded, and it was the first one funded. Yeah, it was the first one funded, and with that funding, we were able to develop the program on the Coconino, because that's where the money was funneled through for fiscally, for a number of years, and then eventually, it was funneled through the Arboretum. So
The funding was coming from nationally?
It was national. I'd have to look it up.
Some Department of Agriculture kind of thing?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
I'll have to look it up.
That would make sense. Yeah.
Because it was... A lot of people thought we didn't have any problems out here in the West. You know, all the problems were back east in the farmlands and in the woods and stuff in the areas that had been settled forever and ever. And, they had a lot of problems back east. They did. They had serious, serious problems.
Right.
But we began to get them out here, especially once we began to look for them and what was coming in. So, yeah.
I did want to ask you a question. We were at a slideshow recently, maybe a month or so ago, in Phoenix for a history symposium. and there was a presentation on the logging that was happening in northern Arizona.
Hmm.
And one of the photographs in that presentation showed a train car with logs on it. The logs were maybe 8 to 10 feet in diameter.
I can imagine, yeah.
They were stunningly large.
Right.
For a climax forest.
Were they ponderosa pines or Doug fir?
I don't know. I want to say fir.
Doug fir was harvested, I think, I just my own impression, first, is as big timber.
Okay.
And of course, they did harvest the ponderosas as big timber, but I don't think of them as getting that big that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And Doug fir could have. I know my own house has Doug fir flooring in it.
And, right. That is and like it's continuous an old house. Room yeah. to room, end of room to end of room.
Right, yeah.
No butt ends in the middle of the room, just these huge long boards.
Yeah, I'd have to look at them, but yeah, it's definitely Doug fir.
Yeah. What do you think the logging and ranching did to this area? This is going back 150 years ago, 140, maybe 130 years ago, to change the ecology and the vegetation here.
Well, you know, the earliest reports state that they could ride horses through the forest and the grass was up to their bellies. And it was so open you could gallop through the forest and things like that. So it was actually when they stopped, not that they were harvesting then, they weren't, but the cattle came in and ate the grasses, and they brought in a lot of cattle and sheep.
Yes.
And there's a little article that I read, a little booklet, when I was working on that Miriam exhibit that I mentioned before, where it was like Flagstaff Whoa or something was the title of it. And it told about the early ranchers and how many thousands of sheep they had and how many of the water troughs they had, like at Little Springs where Miriam camped.
Hmm.
You know, there was like 20 water troughs for the animals there, whatever. And it was open country. And it isn't like it is today.
Right, it was open range.
But it was also open trees. I mean, right. it wasn't until a long while before they started to get concerned because they started cutting all the trees out and everything.
Right.
And then they didn't get seedlings coming up. And it's sort of like the cactus that I talked about that were episodic.
Mm.
The pine trees are episodic too. A lot of things are adjusted to the climate. And so they didn't have a burst of little baby pine trees for a long time. And so then they got worried about that. And that's how the research and stations got established in the forests.
Okay.
Like out in Fort Valley, you know, there's a research station there.
Yep.
There's the one in Tucson at Tumamoc Hill.
Right.
And so once they got researchers out that were like ecologists that could look at the big picture of all these different ecosystems, they came up with different theories as to why they acted the way they did and everything. And I know one theory was that the pine trees grew better on the limestone soils down by the rim and they just didn't do as well up here in the volcanics. Hmm. But you know, they do fine on the volcanics. They come in after fires. So now, or disturbance, they sort of stopped the disturbance for a while.
Okay.
And then you got all those dog hair thicket things coming in.
Right.
And now, if you go out 180 and look, they're really thinning the forest really back. But you have all these little pine trees coming in.
Yeah.
Because it's been disturbed. They're running the vehicles over the stuff and they've opened it up to the light and the sun and the moisture. But now it's hotter and drier and the winters aren't as predictable and everything.
Right.
And they don't have the fire going in on an episodic basis. So.
And it seems as though that Doug fir forest it's just a long time to get to that stage
where they grow longer.
Spread out, they've shaded the the ground underneath them. Mm. There's a tall forest with grassland, understory, mm-hmm. no dog hair stuff happening. Right. It takes a long time to do that. And of course, then you have temperature changes and fluctuations of drought and moisture. But it just seemed as though when you showed up for your job in 1990, there was 100 years of fairly major alteration mm-hmm. to the biotic community.
Right. Here. Yeah. Well, there was in one sense, and there wasn't in another. In other words, the indigenous people burned
mm-hmm.
on a regular basis too.
Right.
And that would keep it open.
Right.
And of course, they were stopped from. Mm. I mean, they were decreased in number. Right. They weren't. They were put on reservations. They didn't. Sure. They weren't allowed to roam.
But then the Forest Service had a mission for stopping every smoke. I mean,
yeah. Well, that came in sort of in the early 1900s.
Right.
When they had some disastrous fires and people got killed trying to fight the fires. They didn't have a way to fight fires back then.
Mm.
There was a big fire on the peaks. You've seen all the aspens and stuff like that. That was a big fire that came through there.
Right.
In 1911 or something like that. And they couldn't stop fires. And it's getting to the point where they can't stop fires today again.
Exactly.
So it's going to make a big difference.
Hmm.
The thing that we have different now is we don't have the cooler weathers and we don't have the monsoons that we used to have. And we don't have the rain patterns that aren't so regular. And we're not getting good winters. And, you know, so things are changing and we don't know how to adapt to the changes yet either, I don't think.
Right. Okay. Well, I just wanted to kind of touch base on that, thinking about invasives and what's the baseline. So that's my next question: is what is the baseline? I mean, and as you mentioned, indigenous peoples were burning pre-contact, meaning pre-Clovis.
Well, I wasn't going back that far. I was even just going back before the Spanish came and
if we recognize pre-Homo sapien. Pre-us as a species.
Okay.
That's an ecology.
Right.
Post-us as a species.
Right.
Pre-1890s.
Right.
There's an ecology there. And then the last 100 years, there's an ecology there.
Yeah.
Well,
and then there's ecology right now going on, too. I mean, definitely climate change the last 30 years or whatever.
So, you know, so in your opinion, as a botanist, what snapshot in time does it behoove us to manage for? Or does it? I mean, here we are today, so we have temperatures and we have where we are today.
I think we're struggling to learn how to manage the current thing because it's changing really rapidly.
Okay.
And people before this in forestry, in the time period when Chuck was here and the people that were in the forestry school and everything, they tried to manage for a vision of sort of late 1800s before all the cattle came and you know they had ideas of how to restore it from the really dense forest to more open kind of forest
mm-hmm.
but I think that it's going by the wayside. It's too hot now, too dry, mm-hmm. too unpredictable, too many things that I think they're floundering in knowing exactly. You see examples of where they're on one forest, they're trying something or other, and you go over. I just heard this the other day, you know, with people sort of laughing and saying, well, we watch what the Coconino does and then how it turns out, and then we go do something different.
Okay.
So they say, okay, you know, they tried this, they tried that, wasn't work, so maybe we should do something different.
Right.
So it's experimental still. And
it seems like a lot of the forests are turning into grasslands with the fires.
Big
fires are just...
Yeah, but there were a lot of grasslands in the past. We just don't recognize them. And mm-hmm. then you have, like you were bringing up, the fact that's from the Pleistocene studies and such that they did with pack rat mittens, they found that, you know, these trees and shrubs moved downward, and now they're moving upward and north.
Right.
And so the life zones and whatever are moving more north. Well, then, of course, they're getting into Canada. They're burning up. And they're probably going to be more grassland.
Yep.
And we don't know. We don't know. It's.
But that's a really good point, that species populations change over time, especially when your time period, you know, look at 50,000 years, look at 100,000 years, mm-hmm. start backing up into mm-hmm. a longer and longer timeline. Mm-hmm. And then you see the ebbs and flows of species
right.
as temperatures go up and down or moisture mm-hmm. goes up and down. So that
yeah.
Forget that. And then I'm like, oh, it's got to be like this. No, it doesn't, because it's all going to be, it's a moving elevational scale.
And anyway. I think that's something that is, it's a scientific observations of the world that most of the people are not exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it so hard to possibly be a scientist, is to realize that we're concerned about a lot of things that is way beyond people's imagination, way beyond people's caring about it, and yet they should be,
right?
Because it's going to really affect their children. Everybody talks about to the seventh generation. I think that, you know, Native Americans still have some of that value in their concept of interacting with nature and the world and stuff that is valuable. Mm-hmm, and I look to them as being, having those kind of insights that maybe if they get enough
opportunity,
mm-hmm. Let's call it that, enough, mm-hmm. yeah, that will be really helpful.
You bet.
Because we're not reaching the Anglo settlement people in the big cities and all of that very, very well.
Right, right.
And less so every day, practically. But
cool. Well, thank you for that journey into a deeper timeline. And now we'll scurry back to our normal next time timeline. Okay. Well, with that, let's conclude part 17 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Barbara Phillips. Today is Monday. It's June 2nd, 2025. And Barb, thank you so very much.
Thank you.